the product, not the process of a decision by a network's behind-closed-doors parliament is open to inspection, the conscious mind may have no way of knowing which part is fact and which part is fiction. So how do we learn to distinguish observation from explanation? Let's start with an example. The accounts of outbreaks of vampirism recorded by officials of the Austro-Hungarian Empire tell us repeatedly that those whom people dug out of their graves and proclaimed vampires had not decomposed, being often plumper than when buried, with fresh-looking blood at their mouths. The villagers then took steps to kill these blood-sucking vampires by as many means as possible, staking, decapitation, cremation, and so forth, to ensure that they didn't come back to hurt the living anymore. The medical doctors sent by the government to keep an eye on things described one such scene thus. The villagers found that the exhumed dead man was quite complete and undecayed, and that fresh blood had flowed from his eyes, nose, mouth, and ears, that the old nails on his hands and feet, along with the skin, had fallen off, and that new ones had grown. And since they saw from this that he was a true vampire, they drove a stake through his heart, according to their custom, whereby he gave an audible groan and bled copiously. Grew new skin and nails? Bled copiously? Groaned? Can't be. Dead men don't talk, nor do they grow fat in the grave. Throw the old wives' tales out. But not so fast. Each of the observations here happens to be clinically verifiable down at the coroner's office. Dead bodies often do get plumper from the gases formed by decomposition. Furthermore, pressure from the gas, not to mention from a pounded steak, can force a person's own blood out the orifices. Blood typically coagulates soon after death, but often reliquefies later. The tendency of the nails to fall off, exposing the smooth pink nail bed, not, in fact, new nails, but who's going to get close enough to scrutinize, was so well known to the ancient Egyptians that they tied the nails on with little metal toe and finger caps. The peeling of the outer layer of skin, exposing a fresh-looking layer beneath, is well known to forensic pathologists as skin slippage. And shoving a stake into the chest can push air out the lungs past a still intact glottis or voice box, producing a groaning sound, though not articulated speech, exactly as in life. So it's all true, except for the explanation that he was plumper because he was sucking blood from the living, and that all of these things occurred because the dead man's spirit had not yet vacated the body. In short, that he was still somehow alive. But we are free to examine and accept the observations without embracing the explanation. That leads us to the stripping procedure. In order to understand the true original events, we have to see clearly what the events are. In order to do that, we must strip the explanations from the story. As a countercheck, note that if one temporarily accepts the explanation, then the actions that follow seem rather logical. If you truly believed that the vampire was alive, then re-killing its body would seem the natural next step. And if the original means of death had not been sufficient to separate the animating principle from the flesh, it would behoove you to try everything in your arsenal this time around. Once again, we see that people weren't so silly. They just didn't have enough facts at their disposal to come up with theories more to our taste. Note, too, that not only are their observations given to us tangled with their explanations, but their explanations are a function of their belief system, which in turn has suffered from the silence principle during transmission. Similarly, in the Crater Lake story, when we remove the explanations, we find a geologically verifiable description of the eruption and collapse of Mount Mazama. We get the added information that the Klamath tribe fled into the lake, While two of its elder members jumped into the inferno shortly before the final collapse, although we cannot verify these details, we no longer have cause to reject them. Now turn to the explanation that we peeled away. If you truly believed that something as extreme as the river of fire chasing you from your home had been sent in revenge by the chief of the below world, then it would make sense to resort to something as extreme as human self-sacrifice as a countermeasure. Thus, another very efficient principle for analyzing myth is the logic cross-check. Investigating the logic of the actions of the participants serves as a useful cross-check that we have suitably separated their explanations from their observations. The ways the brain has of filling in the gaps in its knowledge, as much as it fills in the eye's blind spot, are numerous. For example, linguistic research shows that if people are asked to repeat a sentence that is too long and complex for them to remember verbatim, they will reword it in such a way as to get the general sense across. Or, if given short ones, they will combine them to capture the sense. Jeremy Campbell summarizes another well-known memory experiment, in this case conducted by John Bransford and Jeffrey Franks, who constructed lists of sentences as follows. At the highest level of complexity was a sentence like, "The rock which rolled down the mountain crushed the tiny hut at the edge of the woods." This same idea was broken down into parts and represented by four shorter and simpler sentences. The rock rolled down the mountain. The rock crushed the hut. The hut was tiny. The hut was at the edge of the woods. Students who took the test were given only some of these shorter fragments. They were not given any of the long sentences which expressed the complete set of ideas, so that they were exposed to no more than bits and pieces of the full meaning of the complex sentences. Nor were the students allowed to spend time thinking about the material. At the end of this stage of the test, the complete list of sentences was read out, and the students were asked to say how familiar each sentence sounded to them. In general, a top rating was given to the sentences which combined all the ideas, even though the students had never heard these sentences before. Actual familiarity turned out to have almost nothing to do with how the students responded. All that mattered was that a sentence was or was not compatible with the complete, most complex idea which the students had abstracted from the short fragments. In other words, as Campbell puts it, out of disconnected elements, a complete meaning is constructed, and that is what a person remembers. Frederick Bartlett, in his classic experiments about remembering stories, came to similar conclusions. Over the years, we have repeatedly encountered a similar phenomenon in the oral retelling of myths and stories. Movie construct. Explanations that were derived from seeing only the result of an event, as in a single snapshot, tend to be presented as an integral part of a story that moves through time, as in a movie reel. That is, the story we receive has often been put together or reconstituted from single events or observations, on the basis of an explanation treated as given rather than as deduced. There is no overt indicator that this is the case, of course, since the narrators assume that their hearers would make the same unstated assumptions as they did. Take, for example, the following account of an Austrian exhumation from 1893. To the horror of the authorities, it was discovered that not only had the pregnant woman been buried alive in a trance-like or cataleptic condition, but she had put up the most incredible struggle within the coffin. During the course of this, she had given birth to a child. Both had suffocated to death. Everything here is explanation, rationalization. But what had people actually seen? They could only have seen, one, the dead bodies of mother and baby, where they expected the body of a pregnant woman, and two, evidence of violent movement within the coffin, where they expected dead quiet. Now, forensic pathologists will tell you that it often happens that the pressure of those decomposition gases we mentioned typically forces an unborn fetus out of a dead mother, so-called coffin birth, and causes many other sorts of movements in dead bodies, even sitting upright. One reason we get the dead out of sight as fast as possible is that we don't care to watch such manifestations, especially in a loved one. But that means that most of us know almost nothing about these processes. In other words, all the end results can be accounted for by simple decomposition. The writer of this account, however, ignorant of modern forensic pathology, has deduced that the mother had A, not been dead when buried, B, been in a trance instead, C, awakened, D, struggled, E, given birth to a live baby, and finally F, suffocated in the coffin with her newborn. A complete newsreel. And no mention is made of the actual state of affairs that the gravediggers observed, everything being couched in terms of what are silently assumed to be the causes or explanations of these final results. What is particularly comical or scary is that half of this newsreel was invented by a modern author, Anthony Masters, in 1972, on the basis of his own assumptions. The much simpler 1896 report from which he got the case says that 3 days after death, the woman was buried, and a few days later, on suspicion of poisoning, exhumed. It was then found that she had but very recently died, and the appearance of her body indicated that she had undergone a terrible struggle. Moreover, she had given birth to a child in her coffin. The physician who had signed her certificate of death was sentenced to a few weeks' imprisonment as a punishment for his carelessness. No mention of trance, awakening, giving live birth, or suffocation. Movie constructs are still alive and well. Jeremy Campbell has a further remark of interest here. He points out that when information is recollected, the elaborations added by the brain may behave like a memory, so that people have the mistaken impression that the extra information is part of the original message. Once placed in memory, the two kinds of information are not easily disentangled. The students in the test were certain that they had heard the full, most complex sentences expressing the complete idea, when in reality they had constructed them out of fragments. Similarly, in myth, as in many eyewitness statements in court and numerous memory experiments, the observations and constructed explanations come at us in a tangle. So when we are confronted with fantastic myths, like that of Prometheus having his liver pecked out by an eagle as he lies chained to a mountain, or Loki having snake venom dripped on him as he lies chained to rocks, we can do better than throwing them out, or even than merely guessing the two tales are somehow related. But to understand them, we must understand the cornerstone of how our brains handle data: analogical patterning. Chapter 5. Analogy, Our Brain's Best Talent. Analogy Principle. If any entities or phenomena bear some resemblance in any aspect, they must be related. Analogy sits at the very core of language itself. As children, we hear book, books, and cat, cats, and figure out for ourselves by analogy that the plural of cup will be cups. That this, and not imitation alone, is the underlying process becomes quite clear from the child who, equally cleverly, comes up with foot, foots. We know that no such form was used in his or her presence, therefore the child made it up by extracting and reapplying analogically a pattern or rule based on other forms heard. That means that ever since we set our feet, or foots as the case may be, on the road to language, our brains have been selected for adeptness at doing analogies, in fact, rewarded for it, since the child who demands that Mama put shoes on his foots will get them just as surely as if he had said feet. The message, the whole point of language, gets through even though the form is unusual, because an adult can make the same unconventional analogy in a flash. We often initiate some unconventional stuff ourselves as adults, especially when we encounter new and unfamiliar forms. Thus, when a French word for a small green legume came into English long ago, as in the ditty, "Peas porridge hot, peas porridge cold," we thought, well, there are a lot of little green balls inside the peas pod, spelled P-E-A-S-E, so just one of them would be a pea, P-E-A. That is, so many speakers of English notice the resemblance of the consonant sound on the end of peas, P-E-A-S-E, to the common English plural suffix that they assumed an S-less form must be the singular and the form with the S the plural, by analogy to practically every other noun in the language. We assume that if two entities bear a resemblance, they must be related. Linguists call this particular form of analogical change backformation. The process that formed foots is extension or generalization. There are other types of linguistic analogy too, and we've been doing all of them for millennia. All we need is to perceive a pattern or resemblance, and like a bridleless horse, we're off and running. And so we find it in mythology, the child of language. If any entities or phenomena bear a resemblance in any aspect, people assume they must be related. Where points of resemblance include form, behavior, cause, significance, or whatever. As with language, analogy of form is the easiest to spot, and we have seen examples already. If the mountain smokes like a chimney, then it plausibly is the chimney of a supernatural creature's home. And just as we gather with our family around the fireplace, so, by analogy, this creature will gather with his family around his gigantic fireplace, and likewise send his kid off on an errand. Sometimes the analogy must have begun as a way of describing the indescribable to those who weren't there. Thus, if a gigantic tidal wave rushes onto land, roaring and shaking the earth and destroying everything in its path, it may be likened to a bull on the rampage. In Aegean mythology, the bull from the sea. A woman who witnessed the great Alaska quake of 1968 from her house on a hillside reported that the ground opening up in multiple furrows looked like something being raked open by an invisible giant's claw. Before written records, it only takes a touch of the silence principle, dropping the word like, to change this into an actual giant raking the ground open. In this simple way, analogy can often provide a very satisfying explanation for how things are. It can also provide a guide for how to act. For instance, one of the most famous analogical acts of the ancient Near East was the ritual sacred marriage, in which the king mated with the high priestess in imitation of the desired mating of the divine male and female principles of nature. The purpose, of course, was to promote fertility by analogical means. Or take another example. If I am very angry, I might well be mollified by an expensive gift that says, "I'm sorry." So if the chief of the below world is enraged, those experiencing his curse of fire might succeed in placating him with a gift, a sacrifice. If the Nile does not rise at the proper time with its life-giving floodwaters, then perhaps the river is angry at something and needs a bribe or two. We tend to take the moral high ground today in our view of things because we strive to discover cause and effect, the logical or scientific explanation. The cause of the Nile's mysterious late summer flood in Egypt is perfectly ordinary. Most of it comes from spring monsoons in Ethiopia and some from spring meltwaters around Lake Victoria, both of which lie so far south of Egypt that the floodwaters reach the mouth of the Nile only months later. Less rain and/or delayed melting in these distant areas are what retard the Nile flood. But because the Nile is over 4,000 miles long, with a vast area of formerly impassable swampland in its mid-region, nobody got the data together to figure out the exact sources of the Nile until the late 19th century. In the meanwhile, those whom the flood affected strove to provide an analogical or mythical explanation by observing shared similarities. The Nile, like a responsible citizen, rose because it chose to do its part, and failed to rise because, like a balky one, it refused to. Fortunately, two can play at that game. If the Nile is like a citizen, treat it accordingly. To keep life on course, the pharaoh made gifts to the Nile every year about the time when it was due to rise. To these sacrifices, which were thrown into the river, a document was added. It stated, in the form of either an order or a contract, the Nile's obligations. Analogy is so plastic that we will consider its application to mythology in nearly a dozen specific forms. Much of our reasoning, however, while involving very apt analogies, simultaneously falls into a rather slippery logical fallacy. Over the millennia, we've become very good at analogical reasoning, but we've done little to wire up our brains for pure logic, especially deductive logic. As a result, most people's minds simply duck out for a siesta when if P and then Q come into the conversation. In fact, the more that cognitive scientists try to construct artificial intelligence, the more they find our brains to be unlike computers based on serial logic. Instead, our brains have grown up to access masses of related data simultaneously, sifting for the best overall pattern match to known experience, so as to turn up practical solutions to such things as evading the lion's jaws as fast as possible. This inbuilt preference for navigating from ready experience rather than airtight logic turns up repeatedly in mythic thinking. But in so navigating, we often slither into what logicians call the fallacy of affirming the consequent. I know that if P, then Q is true. I have Q, not P, so I assume that P must be true. Let's put that into our preferred concrete terms. I know that P, if Sam is driving in, then Q, it's time for dinner. So I conclude that since it's now time for dinner, Sam must be driving in. In practice, 99% of the time I'm right. As the clock strikes 6:30, Sam turns into the driveway. But despite the high percentage of success of this gambit, it is not a deduction that follows the laws of logic, as we can see if we change the values of P and Q. I know that P, if I have a rattlesnake, then Q, I have a snake with a poisonous bite. But that does not mean that if I have a snake with a poisonous bite, it is a rattler. It could be a cobra or a copperhead, for instance. The problem is that I have Q, not P, and it was P that entailed Q, not the other way around. Yet we behave much of the time as though an implication and its reverse were equivalent. This is because, since we prefer practical solutions over abstract ones, we tend to rely on what we know usually happens rather than on a tight logical analysis. The fallacy of affirming the consequent leads in all sorts of interesting directions. Let's take a simple one. We keep dishes in the cupboard, and whenever we need dishes, we go get them from the cupboard, because that's where they reside. Analogously, we keep clothes inside the closet and go fetch them from there when needed. Likewise, whenever we need fire, we go and get it from matches, or in previous ages, from flint. Therefore, fire resides inside matches and/or flint. Many cultures do, in fact, have myths that fire made its home in flint or in certain kinds of wood. The next question, of course, is how it got there. And the answers are variously that the flint or tree must have eaten fire or hidden fire from an enemy at some time in the past. Either way, it now has fire inside it. And so, courtesy of the fallacy of affirming the consequent, we have the container corollary. A source container and a resident thing contained may be assumed where scientists consider cause and effect the appropriate relation. Take as illustration the following myth, told by a variety of tribes living from northern Washington to northern California. It tells of coyotes' attempt to steal fire from mortals from three old skookums, evil spirits, who night and day guarded the only fire up on top of a mountain. Coyote stationed the fastest animals at intervals up the mountain, and when he finally succeeded in stealing a firebrand, he ran as fast as he could with the skookums hot on his heels. Exhausted, he passed the brand to the nearest animal he had stationed, which ran to the second, and so on in relays down the mountain. All hoped the skookums would soon be tired out. At last, when only a coal was left, it was given to Squatty Little Frog. Squatty Little Frog swallowed the hot coal and hopped away as fast as he could hop. The youngest skookum, though she was very tired, was sure she could catch Frog. She seized his tail and held tight, but Frog did not stop. He made the biggest jump he had ever made, and he left his tail behind him in the skookum's claws. Ever since, frogs have had no tails. Still, Frog did not stop. He made a long, deep dive into a river and came up on the other side, but the skookum leaped across. A second time, she caught up with Frog. He was too tired to jump again. To save the fire, he spat it out of his mouth on wood, and wood swallowed it. The other two skookums joined their sister. All three stood by, helpless, not knowing how to take the fire away from wood. Slowly, they went back to their lodge on top of the mountain. Then Coyote came to the place where the fire was, and the people came close, too. Coyote was very wise. He knew how to bring fire out of wood. He showed people how to rub two dry sticks together until sparks came. He showed them how to use sparks to make chips and pine needles burn. And so, to this day, wood contains fire, and fire resides in wood. Possibly as an extension of this idea of the resident in the container, or possibly from sheer analogy of form, carved or graphic images are often treated as containing or providing residences for supernatural spirits associated with those forms. By setting up such an image, one could hope to entice the deity to come into residence to hear one's prayers. The renowned Egyptologist John Wilson provided the following discussion of this subject in an essay on the nature of the Egyptian worldview. A god represented something important in the universe, the sky, a district of Egypt, or kingship. In terms of his function, that god had extensiveness and intangibility. But he might have a localization in the world, in a place where he might feel at home. That is, a shrine might be specified for him. In that shrine, he might have a place of manifestation in an image. This image was not the god. It was merely a mechanism of stone or wood or metal to permit him to make an appearance. This is stated by the Egyptians in one of the creation accounts. The creator god acted for the other gods, and he made their bodies like that, with which their hearts were satisfied. So the gods entered into their bodies of every kind of wood, of every kind of stone, or every kind of clay in which they had taken form. Memphite theology. These images were provided for them so that they might have places in which to take visible form. Thus, the god Amun might be at home in a stone statue of human form, in a specially selected ram, or in a specially selected gander. He remained himself and did not become identical with this form of appearance, and he had a different form of appearance for a different purpose, just as humans might maintain different homes or might have different garments. The parallelism of these religious images to containers for residents is apparent, but the god may also be postulated to have a particular form because his or her behavior resembles something visible. We are now analogizing from behavior to form. Thus, the Egyptians likened the round sun rolling across the sky each day to another ball that they frequently saw propelled great distances, the dung ball pushed by the industrious dung beetle or scarab. Hence, scarabs made in precious materials were often used to represent the sun deity. Since a deity, then, can take up various residences, we must quell our surprise at the variety of manifestations. Thus, Zeus, Jupiter, may appear equally in a planet, a lightning storm, or an oak. Another more opaque case of containment occurs in the Egyptian myth of Isis and Osiris. Seth jealously kills his brother Osiris, then puts the body into a chest, which he throws into the Nile so it will be carried away. When Isis learns of the murder, she searches far and wide for her husband's body. Eventually, she finds it, but not in Egypt. At Byblos, far up the east coast of the Mediterranean, she locates the body and coffin inside a tree being used as a pillar in the king's palace. Reworded, there is a special tree that exists only up in the Levant that contains Osiris, Lord of the Dead. We know from numerous documents that the Egyptians could obtain only from the Levant certain tree resins they needed for the proper embalming of the dead, and when widespread warfare cut them off from this trade, the Egyptians lamented bitterly their inability to tend to the dead properly. Here, with these resins, we have Osiris in a tree. That this lucrative tree formed the pillar of the local king's palaces may have been true monetarily as well as literally, analogy on another level. But to understand better the many forms that analogy takes in myth, we need to turn to the most pivotal of all the myth principles, a joint offspring of the analogy principle and the fallacy of affirming the consequent. Chapter 6. Willfulness. The Atom or Thou? If the wind blows, somebody is blowing it. If the earth quakes, somebody is shaking it. C. Bagley, 1930. Willfulness principle. Humans will things to happen, then set about to make them happen. Therefore, if something happens, it must have been willed. Suppose a tree suddenly falls over in the forest. If others account for this by saying that somebody invisible pushed it, the explanation probably seems implausible. But consider our explanation, that an unimaginably large number of unimaginably small and invisible particles, working in concert, but without any cognitive capacities to coordinate their activities, pulled the tree down. Is that really easier to believe? Especially for someone who knows nothing of the complex theory of gravitational pull by atomic particles. Without thousands of years of recorded data fed through the geniuses who led to modern physics, the simplest explanation is that the tree fell either because it chose to, or because someone willed it to do so, an analogy of cause, if you like, to daily life. But if we can't see anyone or anything making many of the observable things happen, then we must conclude that some possessors of wills are invisible. Enter the deities and spirits, invisible possessors of will, who can make things happen out of nowhere. They push trees over in the forest, bang things in the night, cure you of illnesses they gave you in the first place, make rivers rise and the sun, moon, and stars cross the sky. The question now is not what made the tree fall, but who made it fall. And to answer the latter, one's entire attention and data-collecting capacities are focused in a different direction. The Frankfurts, in their groundbreaking essay, Myth and Reality, refer to this as the I-Thou principle. The fundamental difference between the attitudes of modern and ancient man as regards the surrounding world is this. For modern, scientific man, the phenomenal world is primarily an it. For ancient, and also for primitive man, it is a thou. They continue, an object, an it, can always be scientifically related to other objects and appear as part of a group or a series. Hence, science is able to comprehend objects and events as ruled by universal laws, which make their behavior under given circumstances predictable. Thou, on the other hand, is unique. Thou has the unprecedented, unparalleled, and unpredictable character of an individual, a presence known only insofar as it reveals itself. Thus, for example, we moderns view the properties of flint in terms of its chemical structure, which we have deduced from a great backlog of laboratory analysis. But the Sumerologist Thorkild Jacobson describes the ancient Near Easterners' knowledge of flint by saying that a particular lump of flint had a clearly recognizable personality and will. Dark, heavy, and hard, it would show a curious willingness to flake under the craftsman's tool, though that tool was only of horn, softer than the stone against which it was pressed. Now, this characteristic personality which confronts one here, in this particular lump of flint, may meet one also over there, in another lump of flint. Wherever one met it, its name was flint, and it would suffer itself to flake easily. That was because it had once fought the god Ninurta, and Ninurta had imposed flaking on it as a punishment. From Jacobson, 1949. To the person who experiences the world as thou, the behavior of flint reveals submissiveness that must have resulted from punishment for wrongdoing, not silica with a structure leading to conchoidal fracturing. As the Frankfurts put it, thou is not contemplated with intellectual detachment. It is experienced as life confronting life. Consider again the first myth we encountered, that of Crater Lake. From widespread studies, we've come to view volcanoes as vents for liquid rock melted by tectonic forces inside the earth. On the macro scale, one volcano is pretty much like another. But those who suffered from the explosion of Mount Mazama had only gotten as far as noting that some mountains had fire inside them. On the micro scale, when that fire came forth, it had the unprecedented, unparalleled, and unpredictable character of an individual. By the willfulness principle, a clearly malevolent will was revealing itself in pouring forth the river of fire, nay, the curse of fire. Indeed, each of the volcanoes up the coast was regarded as involving a quite different will, as revealed by their different behaviors. Mount Shasta was the abode of a beneficent spirit, variously the chief of the above world or the sky spirit. Mounts Hood and Adams were said to be two warrior sons of the great spirits, who fought as rivals for the love of Sleeping Beauty Mountain. Another myth posits our Mount Rainier as the estranged wife of a very tall and handsome young man, our Mount Baker, both of whom keep stretching higher and higher to try to see each other. Note the analogies on every level. Two mountains that are getting higher are like two people stretching to see better. Two nearby mountains that erupt are like people fighting over something. In fact, two mountains that look similar must be members of the same clan or family, just as among humans, the members of a family often look very much alike. Thus, we arrive at the kinship principle. If two willful phenomena are perceived as alike, they must be kinsfolk. Scientists say like effects imply like causes, but myths say like effects imply kinship between the willful beings. All over the world, the winds are described as siblings, and the sun and moon as brother and sister, although which gender belongs to which depends on the culture. In the Greco-Roman tradition, the moon goddess Artemis Diana was twin sister to the sun god Apollo, but for the Norse, the sun was a goddess and the moon her brother. Likewise for the Japanese, The creator's daughter, Amaterasu, received sovereignty over the sun, and her brother, Tsukuyomi, over the moon. Sometimes analogies of parent-child seem more apt, as in an episode in another myth of the Pacific Northwest. Fair Maiden kept on standing there at the coast, and the winds kept on blowing around her. At last, the changer came to her and said, "Why don't you lie down? If you stand, the winds will blow, and the whirlpools will keep on sucking in the people. Soon there will be none left." So Fair Maiden lay down, and the changer transformed her into Speeden Island. When her child was born, it was a small island of the same shape as Speeden and lying beside it. Today it is called Sentinel Island. Or note the names in this discussion of the big and little volcanoes lying along a rift at Rabaul Harbor in New Guinea. Folklore has it that the active volcano Father, or Ulawun, to the southwest, with two other hills known as South Sun and North Sun, alternate in smoking with the Rabaul volcanoes known as Mother and her two offspring, North Daughter and South Daughter. Likenesses run in families. Indeed, because they are alike in their superior powers, the gods must all be related to each other. Working out their family trees, however, may take eons. To us in the era of science, resemblance may stem from natural laws or causes, historical relatedness, through either inheritance or borrowing, or pure accident. Linguists find it so when tracing similar-sounding words of similar meaning in different languages. Thus, the word for mother in many languages sounds something like English mama, for two natural reasons. First, consonant plus vowel syllables, repeated, constitute the first attempts at vocal production in all children. Our brains just happen to be built that way. And second, pressing the lips together is not only one of the simplest ways of cutting off the airstream, ah is what we sound like with our mouths wide open, but it is the articulation most visible to infants watching adults speak, and one well under control from nursing. On the other hand, the resemblance among English stood and Latin status, Greek status, Sanskrit sita, Russian stall, all meaning stood, results from historical relationship. All five languages are changed later forms of a common ancestor language we call Proto-Indo-European, and this word was inherited by each from that language. We could have chosen any number of inherited words for our example. English new corresponds to Latin novus, Greek nevos, Sanskrit nava, Russian novij. We could also choose similar words with a quite different historical relation. French sandwich and Russian sandvich resemble English sandwich because the first two languages borrowed it from English after the fourth Earl of Sandwich made the concept popular in the late 18th century. But case three, English bad and Persian bad, which mean the same, or German hab, have, and Latin hab, have, are the result of purest accident, Latin cap, capture being the true cognate of Germanic hab, have. Natural laws, historical relatedness, accident. Filing accurately into these three categories requires masses of information. Non-literate cultures do the best they can, filing data according to shared resemblances. That is, by the sharing of essentials, as the Frankfurts like to put it, on some level, any level. By analogy to our own behavior, these spirits or unseen willers will probably act much like us. Thus, in the story of the sky spirit's daughter getting blown down the mountain, the sky spirit was presented as living with his family in a high-roofed lodge with a smoke hole above the fire, exactly as the local people lived. Gods may live like us. They may also get angry or hungry, go to war or on a mission, fall in love or into a trap. Just as people make choices in their behavior, so presumably do the gods and spirits, and we can try to influence those choices as we would each other's. When the Nile is refusing to rise, we can probably influence its behavior by offering a gift or a bribe, or presenting a contract. If you do this for us, we'll do that for you. Or even, we've done this for you, so you owe us that. Covenants and binding agreements with the gods have been quite common through the ages, and much religious art has been produced to record such covenants, so that both the humans and the gods would remember what they were bound to do. The votive statue, or cloth, or candle, sitting patiently by the altar, may fall into this category, just as surely as the painting representing a crucial mythic or religious event. The woolen peplos that the Athenian women made each year and gave to Athena to clothe her wooden statue depicted the Battle of the Gods and Giants, a horrific contest which Athena helped the gods win. The dress thanked the goddess for saving her people, while reminding her please not to let those giants ever get loose again. And just as mortals make visible reminders of their covenants, so may gods, as in the rainbow promising that a great flood will never again wipe out mankind. Marcel Camus taps deep into our instant understanding of such matters in his film Black Orpheus, 1959. The main character, a musician, tells the two young boys dogging his heels that he plays his guitar on the hillside early each morning to make the sun come up. One night he is murdered. In a panic, the boys search out his guitar and scramble up the hill, trying desperately to play it in his stead, until the sun finally appears. Covenants are one thing, but we can also try to trick the gods to get our way, as we might trick each other. By throwing sacrifices into the Nile before it rose, the pharaoh could trick the river into being the one behind on obligations. I've already paid my half. Now it's your turn. When Atlas returned with the apples of the Hesperides to where Heracles had temporarily shouldered the weight of the sky for him, Atlas told Heracles he was glad to be rid of the burden and that Heracles could keep the job forever. Sure, says Heracles, thinking fast. But would you just take it back for a moment while I adjust the pad on my shoulders? As soon as Atlas had the sky back, Heracles picked up the prize apples and walked off. Mortals tricking the gods gets really dicey, since gods clearly have powers we don't. But there was ample evidence that the gods tricked each other. Coyote tricked not only the Skookums, but also his own sisters in the story of how he obtained fire. At first, he couldn't think of a plan to get the fire. So he decided to ask his three sisters, who lived in his stomach in the form of huckleberries. They were very wise. They would tell him what to do. But at first, his sisters in the form of huckleberries would not help him. If we tell you, they said to Coyote, you will say that you knew that yourself. Coyote remembered that his sisters did not like hail, so he looked up into the sky and called out, Hail! Hail! Fall down from the sky! His sisters were afraid and cried, Stop! Stop! Don't bring the hail! Don't bring the hail! We will tell you whatever you need to know. Then his three sisters told him how he could get a brand of fire from the three Skookums, and how he could bring it down the mountain to the people. When they had finished talking, Coyote said, Yes, my sisters, that is what I thought. That was my plan all the time. In fact, Coyote is a classic example of what anthropologists call a trickster figure. Tricksters occur in the mythologies of many cultures, for example, Maui in Hawaii, Hermes in Greece, and the prototype of Br'er Rabbit in Africa. Possibly the most renowned trickster from European culture was the Germanic Loki, a highly ambiguous figure treated as sometimes doing great good and sometimes great evil. Although a member of the race of giants, inherently evil, he hung out most of the time with the race of gods, inherently good, just as in Greece. The gods frequently begged him to defeat their enemies with his tricks, but he was constantly playing pranks on the gods, too, for which they punished him. He cut off the grain goddess Sif's golden hair and even caused the death of Baldur, a favorite among the gods. For his transgressions, he was chained to a mountain and tortured. This ambivalent deity will become less opaque as we go. Meanwhile, as we consider myths about willful beings, we must beware. Since anything that happens may be perceived as willed, we mustn't assume that everything presented as having a will and a name is a living person in our sense. This holds not just for the Nile and the chief of the below world, but as we shall see, for Loki and Sif, Prometheus, Heracles, and so on. If divine manifestations that resemble each other are kin, then opposites must hate each other. Adversary principle. If two phenomena are perceived as the opposite of each other, they must be bitter enemies. In Christian tradition, God and Lucifer are arch enemies. One, the principle of all that is good, the other of all that is evil. Interestingly, in the Bible, this story is presented initially starting from the other end, much as in the movie construct. Lucifer, literally bringer of light, was once high in heaven, we learn. But when Lucifer set himself up as a rival to God's power, he was thrown out of heaven like a meteor to become God's opposite, both in nature and in location. How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of dawn! How you are cut down to the ground! You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. Above the stars of God I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the Mount of Assembly in the far north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. But you are brought down to the Sheol, to the depths of the pit. Isaiah 14. Another interesting pair of opposites, though not so starkly black and white, is Athena and Poseidon. They are constantly at loggerheads with each other, contesting for possession of Athens, and fighting each other for the life and homecoming of Athena's devotee, crafty Odysseus. To see this opposition clearly, we must investigate what each is in charge of. Translators call Athena the goddess of wisdom, but that's not quite accurate, even if it might be later for her approximate Roman counterpart, Minerva. We see Athena revered as the protectress of her city of Athens, in charge of the fertility of its inhabitants, flocks and crops, as well as goddess of warfare, shipbuilding, spinning, and weaving. That covers a lot. But it all falls into place if we take seriously her epithet as goddess of techne, whence our word technology, which designates all that human craft can accomplish, including agriculture and warfare. Poseidon, for his part, was associated with the sea, but in Homer his chief epithet is Earthshaker. He is the bringer of earthquakes. How are quakes and ocean connected? Myths repeatedly associate him with quake-born, ocean-born killer tsunamis, the roaring, pounding bull from the sea, such as that which he sent to fulfill Theseus's curse on his son Hippolytus, drowning the lad as he drove his horses along the shore. Poseidon is, in short, lord of all that is wildest and most untamable in nature, just the opposite of Athena's purview. This opposition shows up immediately in their contest for rule of Athens. Poseidon, seismic to the core, struck a rock and produced a salt spring, while Athena created the first olive tree, the most important and versatile domestic plant in the Aegean. Finding the salt spring remarkably less useful than the olive, the citizens voted Athena as winner. Poseidon revealed his displeasure by sending a tidal wave, what else, in revenge, but Athena saved her people by stopping it at the foot of the Acropolis. Yes, it's entirely possible that an actual tidal wave, such as that from the eruption of Thera in 1625 BC, could build up enough height in funneling up the Saronic Gulf to reach the Acropolis, more than 3 miles, 5 kilometers inland. We'll meet similar waves in Chapter 8. Note, too, that we are again told the explanation as part and parcel of the observation. Observation. A tidal wave came, stopping at the Acropolis. Explanation. Since Athens was saved, it must have been Athena who saved it by turning the tide in the nick of time. And it must have been Poseidon who sent it, since he was in charge of such waves. The method by which we fine-tuned our understanding of Athena's nature, by comparing it to that of her chief adversary, is widely useful enough to state as an analyzing principle, the adversary method. To help determine the domain of a deity, investigate the nature of his or her enemies. Hilda Davidson, struggling to understand the often hazy remnants of Norse mythology, also came upon this method. Discussing Thor, who repeatedly battles evil giants and particularly the world serpent to save both men and gods from destruction, she remarks that despite all the distortions and losses, much may still be learned of the nature of a god by the adversaries whom he encounters. Of all the adversary relations one might imagine, perhaps the most global is that encompassed by the Mesopotamian worldview. As Jacobson explains, every type of event and thing in the entire world was perceived as possessing a will. But the Mesopotamian person's experience of nature was not nearly so safe and reassuring as it was to the Egyptian. Through and under it, he sensed a multitude of powerful individual wills, potentially divergent, potentially conflicting, fraught with a possibility of anarchy. He confronted in nature gigantic and willful individual powers. To the Mesopotamian, accordingly, cosmic order did not appear as something given. Rather, it became something achieved through a continual integration of the many individual cosmic wills, each so powerful, so frightening. Thus, the universe was seen as run by an entire parliament of divine willers, who argued things out on high. Helpless humans, by contrast, served as their insignificant slaves, mere pawns of the mighty. Chapter 7. Multiple Aspects. The more the merrier. Multiple Aspects Principle. A phenomenon may be explained mythically as many times as it has significantly different aspects. Our modern desire to capture a single picture is photographic and static, whereas the ancient Egyptians' picture was cinematic and fluid. For example, we should want to know in our picture whether the sky was supported on posts or was held up by a god. The Egyptian would answer, "Yes, it is supported by posts or held up by a god, or it rests on walls, or it is a cow, or it is a goddess whose arms and feet touch the earth." Any one of these pictures would be satisfactory to him according to his approach, and in a single picture he might show 2 different supports for the sky, the goddess whose arms and feet reach the earth, and the god who holds up the sky goddess. From Wilson, 1949. Our science teachers train us to collect evidence for phenomena, in the hope that we may eventually compress the data into predictive rules or scientific laws. If I perceive that the toast always falls jam-side down when I drop it, I want to formulate a law on the premise that like effects have like causes, and then figure out why the law works that way. If I find an exception, I want to figure out what rule governs the exception. But if the world consists of willful beings who make things happen by personal choice, beings who make my toast land on its sticky side out of spite or amusement, then one is not led to search for impersonal rules, but rather to ask, who caused that, and why me? Any avenue of approach related to the situation might lead to the key. Any resemblance to or point of contact with something else may prove useful to the problem of the moment. The circumstances under which I upended my toast today differed from yesterday's debacle. To know what willer or willers to appease, it behooves me to collect as many analogies as possible to the situation to be explained. A phenomenon may be explained in this way as many times as it has significantly different aspects. Each manifestation of the situation has its analogies. Like the Egyptians, the Greeks had several sun gods, but each represented a different aspect of the sun and its activities. Helios was at base the light-giving disk, whereas Hyperion, literally going over, fastened on the sun in its aspect of crossing the sky each day, and rosy-fingered Eos, dawn, represented the phenomenon of sunlight reappearing each morning. Each of these aspects of the sun contributes in important, willful ways to the total picture. But then what's left for Phoebus, bright Apollo, that handsome and vibrant young man who gave oracles, and at least in classical and late Greek times as sun god, paralleled his twin sister Artemis as moon goddess? His attributes give him away. He appears to represent all that the sun causes by shedding its warming rays on us, vibrant life, hence youth and beauty. And oracles? To understand this, we need to know that most ancient Mediterranean peoples believed vision occurred through light coming out of the eye. Cf. Plato, Timaeus 45. You've seen evidence, animal eyes shining back at you and your lantern or flashlight or headlights at night. By analogy, the great producer of light in the sky must be an eye. But its light shines on everything in the world, so it sees, hence knows everything. Who better to ask for information, then, than the owner of that all-seeing eye? Each analogy has its uses. Thus, in Egypt, the sky as cow is useful for explaining the birth of the sun each day, while the cow goddess arched over the earth helps explain where the stars and other celestial bodies are affixed. The four posts of the sky conveniently uphold the four cardinal directions, or the four points where the sun rises and sets at the solstices. If those celestially appointed pillars were to fall, life as we know it would stop. Many analogies carry emotional baggage. In Norse mythology, gods basically do good deeds, whereas giants do evil ones. The gods bring fertility and life, whereas the giants, many of whom are frost giants, quite understandable in the far north, bring harm and devastation to both gods and men. This differentiation can get quite specific. Thus, Thor is the valiant storm god who brings the life-giving rainstorms, while his lightning smites your enemies, evildoers all, and destroys